Chapter 6. The World of the Small. In this chapter, size matters. The forces of nature vary in strength. The fingerprints of unification. The Planck scale. One of the central themes of particle physics is the relationship of energy and size. In fact, particle physics is commonly called high-energy physics because small size corresponds to high energy. In this chapter, we explore various aspects of this relationship, which gets to the heart of how nature is put together. Small is different. When I was a kid, one of my favorite books was Danny Dunn and the Smallifying Machine, which tells the story of a teenager and his friends who carelessly stumble into a machine that shrinks them to insect size. Just getting something to drink becomes an adventure for them. They find some rainwater in a teacup but have to hit it with a nail, which to them is a sledgehammer, to break the surface tension of the water, an effect that people of normal size seldom notice but that looms large when one is shrunk down. This book has its scientific flaws, but the basic point is sound. The microscopic world is not just a scaled-down version of the macroscopic one. The movie The Incredible Shrinking Man explores the same theme. At the end, the miniaturized protagonist reconciles himself to the prospect of continuing to shrink and encounter new adventures. If the film hadn't stopped there, skirmishes with cats and spiders would have given way to surreal scenes of befriending paramecium, falling between the cracks of molecules and swatting away electrons. The whole fabric of nature would have changed around him as new particles and new laws of physics came into play. It would have become quite a challenge for the Hollywood Special Effects Department of 1957. The driver of these changing conditions is energy. In proportion to their size, small things lead more energetic lives and endure greater fluctuations in energy than we larger things do. It's a raucous place down there. Physicists who want to visit must take heed. The first connection between energy and size is that seeing small things requires high-energy photons. To take a picture of something tiny, we need light with a comparably short wavelength. If the wavelength is too long, the objects we are studying will slip in between wave crests and diffuse the light waves, producing a featureless blur. The wavelength sets the smallest possible pixel size in an image. It also determines the amount of energy carried by each photon of light. The shorter the wavelength, the more energetic the photons. Compared to violet light, red light has a wavelength twice as long, and each red photon carries half as much energy. Infrared and radio photons are even longer and weaker, and ultraviolet and X-ray ones are shorter and more potent. The amount of energy in an individual photon is minuscule, but the mere fact that it varies with wavelength has consequences we can see for ourselves. For instance, to view the heat given off by a person, we need infrared goggles, whereas hotter objects give off a visible glow. As we raise their temperature, they're red hot, then orange hot, then bluish hot. The increasing energy, represented by temperature, means decreasing wavelength, represented by color. Quantum leap. Particle physicists and string theorists typically measure energy in units of electron volts, abbreviated EV. Because energy is related to size by quantum principles, to mass by E equals mc squared, and to temperature by the laws of heat, physicists use electron volts to measure just about everything. I won't bore you with the technical definition. It's better just to think of an electron volt as the amount of energy contained in a single photon of visible light or involved in the chemical reaction of a single molecule. A proton, when annihilated and converted to pure energy, yields just under 1 billion electron volts, or 1 giga electron volt, GeV. Getting a grip on particles. Physicists don't just passively observe particles. They toy with them, pair them up, and burst them open so they can figure out how they tick. It takes finesse to manipulate such small objects, and although we normally think of finesse and brute strength as opposites, they shade into each other in the micro world. The reason for this is that particles aren't sitting around passively waiting for us to manipulate them. To the contrary, they're rather stubborn. Herding them is a bit like herding cats. Forget about cats in the plural, just try to herd a single cat. It's a process of negotiation. If you want her to hang out in the kitchen with you, you need to let her move at her own pace. The moment you try to force the pace, she scurries off and you lose track of where she is. To lure her back into the kitchen is probably going to take some energy on your part. Similarly, the more control you have over a particle's position, the less you can exert over its momentum. To guide particles where you want them to go, you need to give them leeway to spread out in momentum, and that means you need to start them off with a lot of momentum, hence a lot of energy. This trade-off is none other than the famous Heisenberg uncertainty principle. An elegant way of thinking about the trade-off is in terms of waves. Quantum theory describes not just photons, but all particles as waves, indicating the range of locations they can occupy. Typically, such a wave is actually a mixture of pure waves, just as a sound wave is a mixture of pure tones. The wavelength of each pure wave corresponds to one value of momentum. By varying the number of pure waves added together in the mix, we make a trade-off between control over position and control over momentum. For example, if the particle has a specific momentum, the wave describing it is a single pure wave with a specific wavelength. Such a wave has neither beginning nor end. The particle could literally be located anywhere in the universe. The perfect control over momentum means utter lack of control over position. At the other extreme, if a particle has a specific position, the wave must be a mixture of an infinite number of pure waves, arranged to cancel one another out except at that single location. Those waves correspond to an infinite range of momentum. The perfect control over position means utter lack of control over momentum. Usually, a particle falls somewhere in between these extremes. It lingers in a limited range of positions and has a limited range of momentum values. The more confined in position it is, the more spread out in momentum, and vice versa. The momentum spreads to high values, entailing high energy. So, the price of precision tracking is energy. That's also true when particles aren't freely moving. If you pick one up with a pair of tweezers, or something that acts like tweezers, like an electric field, the wave describing the particle has to buckle to fit in. The gap formed by the tweezers sets the maximum wavelength the particle can have, and therefore its minimum energy. As you pinch the particle, it gets more energetic, and you have to be the one to supply that energy.
With enough energy, you can keep a firm enough grip on two particles to bring them close together or force them to collide. Particles also get whipped to high speed in extreme settings such as explosions and the cores of stars. When their momentum is high, particles can be very tightly circumscribed. Any encounters they have with other particles occur at very short distances, so that their fine details become evident. That's why extreme situations require physicists to apply theories of the smallest constituents of matter.
Particles come out. Like a boisterous wedding reception that gets even your dad to do the YMCA dance, the energy of the micro world can bring out the most wallflower of particles. New particles can materialize if the energy crackling in the air is equivalent to their mass, according to Einstein's equation, E equals MC squared. The distance corresponding to this energy threshold is called the Compton wavelength. Every particle has its own value of the Compton wavelength, depending on its mass. For the electron, it's about 2.5 trillionths of a meter, or 2.5 picometers. The energy it takes to guide two particles within 2.5 picometers of each other is also enough to create brand new electrons. Definition. The Compton wavelength is the wavelength for which a particle has enough energy to create a whole new copy of itself. This phenomenon means that new forces can kick in at short distances. An example is the weak nuclear force. Suppose two particles are brought within 10 to the negative 17th power meter of each other. That's the Compton wavelength of the W boson, which carries the weak force. The approaching particles have enough energy to create W bosons and therefore to exert the weak force on each other. If the distance between them is larger than 10 to the negative 17th power meter, there's too little energy to create these bosons, and the weak force barely operates, which is how it came to be known as weak. If the distance is smaller than 10 to the negative 17th power meter, the energy rises still higher, and things far more exotic than the W boson might come out of the woodwork. The two particles are like kids playing a game of catch. The closer they are, the greater the variety of balls they can throw. If they're 60 feet apart, they can throw a baseball back and forth, like particles swapping photons. If they're 25 feet apart, they can choose between the baseball and a dodgeball, like particles able to exchange either photons or W bosons. At 15 feet, they can pass a basketball too. The basketball represents a force that physicists have yet to discover, because they haven't ever gotten particles to come that close together. Particle groupies. The electron we know and love isn't really an electron. The iconic particle of the computer age, the basis of all things electronic, is like a rock star or movie star we never get to see for all the handlers, paparazzi, and autograph seekers that surround it. The true electron is a pinpoint nugget of mass and electric charge surrounded by an entourage of so-called virtual particles, short-lived groupies that can't be seen individually, but collectively screen the genuine article from view. As we will see, this entourage hides not only the particle, but also the essential unity of physics. Virtual particles fill space even when it appears to be completely empty. They're a consequence of the irrepressible bounciness of quantum fields. If we throw a real electron, that is a long-lived one, in among them, the virtual particles rearrange themselves into an entourage. Some of the virtual particles are negatively charged, others are positively charged. The real electron, having a negative charge itself, repels the negatively charged virtual particles and attracts the positively charged ones. Let's think of pairs of virtual particles as boyfriend-girlfriend couples in a throng of groupies around a celebrity. The star is something of a ladies' man, so the girlfriends take an interest. The boyfriends, apart from feeling jealous, are put off by his liking for pedicures and expensive fashions. By pushing away the guys, the star reduces the testosterone charge in his vicinity. Similarly, the electron reduces the density of negative charge in its vicinity, partly offsetting its own charge. Using high energy, which lets us probe short distances, we can muscle our way through the crowd and start to see the electron for what it really is. It's actually more impressive in the flesh than it appears from a distance. Now let's consider a quark. Its electric charge gets offset in the same way an electron's does, but it also has another type of charge, color charge. The color charge attracts a whole other set of groupies, most of which align exactly the opposite way. In terms of the metaphor, the celebrity may have an additional distinguishing characteristic besides gender. Maybe he's a great soccer midfielder. So a male groupie faces a quandary. Is he repelled by the pedicures or attracted by the playmaking? When push comes to shove, men care more about sports than about looks. The celebrity attracts male fans and increases the density of guys in his vicinity. For the quark, the result is that the groupies amplify rather than diminish the color charge. In contrast to the electron, getting close to the quark is a letdown. It cuts a sorry figure on its own. Much of the nuclear force it appears to exert is actually generated by its entourage. Virtual particles sound like an unreal concept, but they have a very real effect on the observed strength of the forces of nature. If we put an electron into a particle accelerator and crank up the energy, we penetrate close to the center of the entourage. The nugget becomes more conspicuous, and the total charge appears to increase. Consequently, the strength of the electromagnetic force exerted by the electron increases by as much as 10% over the range of energies probed by today's particle accelerators. If we do the same with a quark, again, the entourage becomes steadily less important and the nugget more so. In this case, however, the entourage acts to amplify the quark's own color charge, so the total color charge, and therefore the strength of the strong nuclear force, decreases as we move inward. Over the range of energies probed by today's particle accelerators, the force strength varies by several hundred percent. Notice what's happening. As the energy goes up, the size scale shrinks, the electromagnetic force strengthens, and the strong force weakens. The weak nuclear force, for its part, also weakens. Eventually, all three forces become nearly equal in strength. It happens at a distance of about 10 to the negative 31st power meter, which is known as the Grand Unification Scale. Needless to say, that's pretty small. To probe such distances would require a particle of proportionately gargantuan energy, equivalent to the mass of 10 trillion of the heaviest known particles. Definition: the Grand Unification Scale is the distance, or equivalently, energy, at which electromagnetism, the weak nuclear force, and the strong nuclear force become equal in strength. All tangled up. Why is the Grand Unification Distance so small? Actually, the real question isn't why this scale is so small, but why we are so big. Our size is set by the size of the proton, which reflects a balance between electrical and strong nuclear forces. These forces are nearly scale invariant. They vary only mildly in strength with size scale. It takes a huge ratio of sizes for their strengths to change by enough to come into balance. The proton stabilizes at a radius of 10 to the negative 15th power meter. The mere fact that the forces become nearly equal in strength is a strong sign that they're related to one another. Two lines always meet at a point, but for three to do so would be quite a coincidence. It seems that those particle entourages have been hiding nature's true unity from us. By pumping up the energy, physicists can chase the groupies away and see the three forces for what they really are: different aspects of a single force. At the same time, the fact the three lines don't exactly meet suggests that something is still missing. Is string theory that thing? Two types of forces. As significant as the variation in force strength is, it's pretty mild in the grand scheme of things. If we could boost the energy of a quark by a factor of 1 quadrillion, we'd sap the strong force by a factor of only 40. The other forces vary even less. If we plot their strength on a graph, the variation doesn't show up unless we exaggerate the scale. This near constancy is a defining characteristic of electromagnetism and the two nuclear forces. These forces behave in the same way, no matter what the energy or size scale is. They are fundamentally scale invariant, or, in the jargon, renormalizable. Electromagnetism, for instance, always involves two charged particles and one photon at a time. This template stays the same no matter how extreme the conditions get. We don't ever have four charged particles converging. Many other processes in nature are nearly scale invariant, too. The laws of fluid flow are a classic example. They don't care about absolute size. If someone showed you pictures of a great river, a modest brook, and the rivulets in your driveway, you might not be able to tell which is which. To be sure, they're not precisely the same. A miniaturized human being can't easily take a sip of water, and fluids of different composition flow somewhat differently. But these variations can be captured by tinkering with a few quantities in the equations rather than rewriting the equations themselves. The equations fail only when we probe right down to the molecular level. Similarly, although electromagnetism and the nuclear forces vary in strength, these variations are captured by tinkering with a few quantities, such as the charge of the electron. The equations themselves stay fixed. New forces of nature may kick in at short distances, but the equations work right up to the point where that happens, and the large-scale behavior of particles is independent of these fine-scale details. Forces can be scale-dependent, too. For these forces, absolute size matters because their strength varies dramatically with energy. Gravity is the prime example. Newton's law of gravitation indicates that the force between two bodies depends on their masses. If we double the mass of each, we intensify gravity fourfold. Likewise, if we boost the energy of two particles by a factor of 1 quadrillion, 10 to the 15th power, we strengthen their gravity by a factor of 1 quadrillion squared, 10 to the 30th power. The variation of the strong force is a pittance by comparison. Gravity and other scale-dependent forces may be non-players in low-energy particle reactions, but hold their own when conditions are harsher, as they were in the early universe. All tangled up. If gravity is a non-player under everyday conditions, then why does it hurt so much when I fall down? The reason is that gravity, though weak, is cumulative. Each particle in the Earth exerts an undetectably small force, but there are an awful lot of particles, and their gravitation adds up. Electrical forces, by contrast, sometimes add up for like charges, and sometimes cancel out for unlike charges. Scale-dependent forces are much harder to get a handle on. Once we know how a scale-invariant force works at one scale, we know it at all scales. But a scale-dependent force is a shape-shifting beast, ever-changing in behavior. Although scale-dependent forces complicate matters, physicists think that the apparent complexity is an artifact of our imperfect understanding, and that once we apprehend the full structure, we will find it to be simpler. The basement of reality. If gravity is ordinarily weak, but gets stronger so rapidly, it eventually becomes the equal of the other forces of nature. This occurs at the so-called Planck scale. The Planck scale marks the realm of quantum gravity, where gravity becomes a player in particle reactions and where quantum effects intrude into the behavior of gravity. The Planck scale will be a star actor throughout the rest of the book. Definition: the Planck scale is the defining scale of quantum gravity. It can be thought of as either a very short length, the Planck length, or very high energy, the Planck energy. In size terms, the Planck scale is 10 to the negative 35th power meter. To probe it would require pumping a truly epic amount of energy, equivalent to the mass of 100 quadrillion of the heaviest known particles into a single particle. If we tried to pump in any more, the particle would turn into a black hole, and that would be the end of the line. A black hole is almost featureless. We can't see inside it, and if we tried to probe shorter distances by cranking up the energy still further, all we'd do is create a bigger black hole. Consequently, Planck scale objects are the smallest possible pixels in any image. Most physicists think that the Planck scale is the shortest distance that has any meaning at all. Tantalizingly, the Planck scale isn't too far from the grand unification scale I talked about previously. In other words, not only do electromagnetism and the two nuclear forces link up under extreme conditions, but gravity joins in around the same point. This convergence is a further sign they're all related. In fact, unifying some of the forces might require us to unify them all. We might call it the Three Musketeers principle, one for all and all for one. One caveat here is that the value of the Planck scale assumes the forces continue to strengthen at the same rate no matter how high the energy gets. But it's quite possible that the trend changes, in which case the Planck scale may not be quite that small. Whatever its value, this is it. The basement of reality. The last stop on the elevator. Fathoming what happens down there is the job of string theory, loop quantum gravity, or a similar theory. The hierarchy of nature. As the incredible shrinking man shrinks, he scrambles down the tree of physics. The different levels of the tree correspond to different scales of size and energy. One of the most remarkable facts about the world is that these levels remain distinct rather than shade into an undifferentiated blur. The laws governing the world change as you descend, and each set of laws works almost independently of what lies beneath it. An economist can predict broad business trends without having to understand consumers' detailed buying habits. A doctor can suture wounds and fill out insurance paperwork without knowing what makes up the atoms in your body. New properties emerge at each level. Atoms don't breathe. Individual consumers don't go into recession. These are collective attributes of large numbers of atoms or people. The principles that govern organization are at least as important as the makeup of the individual building blocks. The same goes for the Standard Model. It's a description, not only of the constituents of nature, but also of how constituents fit together in a hierarchy. The hierarchy isolates macroscopic creatures, such as us, from what goes on at the very finest scales. The scale invariant forces work much the same, no matter what the size is, so they bear little imprint of the deep structure, and the scale dependent forces wither under the mild conditions of everyday existence. At the same time, the Standard Model offers enough hints of a deep structure to indicate that nature is not an infinite hierarchy, but has a lowest level. The yawning gap between us and the Planck scale is what makes the search for a quantum theory of gravity a journey into the unknown. The least you need to know. Small scales correspond to high energies. At a very short distance, known as the Grand Unification Scale, the three quantum forces become nearly equal in strength. At a still smaller distance, known as the Planck Scale, gravity seems to join in too. Gravity, unlike the three quantum forces, is not scale invariant, which makes it hard to understand.